491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 307. This is part three of our series on the early U.S. oil industry. We're recording this on Sunday, May 10th, 2020. This week, we're going to be talking about understanding rail price wars in a specific region of the United States in a specific time period, namely the northeastern United States, especially Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and the neighboring states, but not New England. And specifically, we're going to be talking about the 1870s, which is the time period that we've been talking about in our previous episodes. So you'll remember that we first talked about the Pennsylvania oil rush starting in 1859, and we talked about in that first episode through the beginning of the 1870s. Then we talked about the period around 1872 when we start seeing the rise of Standard Oil and the various conspiracies by Rockefeller. But what we talked about last week was that the way that Rockefeller was able to achieve his consolidation over the oil refining industry, and then subsequently the rest of the oil industry, was by manipulating the concept of rebates or drawbacks with the railroads. So he was able to negotiate various favorable deals with the railroads that his competitors could not obtain. Sometimes these were semi-legitimate, but mostly they were not really supposed to be doing this. And we're going to be talking this week more specifically about that concept in particular. Joining me, as always, on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
So, Rachel, the thing that I want our listeners to be thinking about as we go through this episode this week, because otherwise, why would we be talking about it, is to be thinking about the modern parallels, which we're going to unpack in a future episode more explicitly. But I want people to start thinking of them as they go through. In particular, in what way do these railroads, which were an important industry, as we'll talk about in this period of the 1870s, in what way do they parallel internet companies today, both in terms of, you know, providing a service to the public under a private corporation with huge public investment up front in the early infrastructure, as well as just kind of the way they operate from a corporate standpoint, and also some of the other tech company satellites, like, you know, companies like Uber and things like that. Rachel, before we jump into this, what were some of the things that you want to flag for the listeners in terms of things to be thinking about in you know, public modern comparisons?
It seems like one of the major things that jumped out at me is the use of debt to kind of advance your business interests. And that's something that we definitely see today, because we have a ton of unprofitable companies that are operating just due to huge influxes of investment cash. And that's something we kind of saw during this time period in regards to the railroads. There was a lot of borrowing going on. There was a lot of investment money flooding into the area. And it didn't always pan out for these railroads that were flush with cash, but then had to kind of leverage that debt in the future, or lost, basically. So,
Yeah, that's a great point. Another one that I think, you know, as we talked about last week with the rebates and drawbacks where they would give, you know, a shipper a huge discount on the back end if they provided a certain number, you know, a certain volume of freight and things like that. That reminds me a lot of some of the sort of money-losing promotional deals, shipping and transportation deals and things that we see today as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way that Amazon and other companies kind of operate at a huge volume, but I don't think there's a lot of money involved in the actual shipping. They're just trying to make up for in quantity and volume those like narrow margins.
All right. So if you've ever taken a sort of basic overarching U.S. history course, you probably have some familiarity with the railroads situation in the 1870s in the United States. But what you probably learned more about was not this particular area of the country. That, again, we're talking mostly about like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York. You've probably heard more about you know, the 1860s Transcontinental Railroad construction, the various frustrations of the farmers and so forth, you know, in the actual western areas west of Chicago, being frustrated with the high prices of rail shipping and agitating over that. You might have heard also about the various scandals in construction of the railroads, the Credit Mobilier scandal, where there was just an outright corruption scandal, bribing federal officials and members of Congress and so forth. You may also have heard about the so-called Railroad Wars of the West, where you'd have, you know, two different rail companies battling it out for control of very narrow mountain passes and canyons and things like that, where they were trying to build these new lines as fast as possible, sometimes quite poor quality because they were just trying to get it done first so that they could, you know, basically be first to market, as we would say today, you know, when we're talking about the tech industry. But today we're going to be talking about the East and a slightly different situation there. As usual, the notes will be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com with this episode in PDF form. This week, we have, in addition to some various other minor sources, we have three major sources. We have The Road of the Century by Alvin F. Harlow in 1947. That's a history of the New York Central Railroad. We have the 1994 book Erie Lackawanna, Death of an American Railroad, 1938 to 1992 by H. Roger Grant, although we're actually focusing on the pre-1938 chapter at the beginning. And then finally, the Pennsylvania Railroad Company, 1846 to 1946, which, interestingly enough, is the railroad's official centennial history of itself. And we, at various points, will note where you should take certain things that they say with a grain of salt about their own sort of corporate history. Those are the three major sources, but let's get into it. So, as I said, if you take a U.S. history course, you might have heard about, like, things like the Grange Movement, which we're going to talk about, or you heard about those Western farmers. Many of them ended up joining that organization, and they were upset in the West about excessively high prices for rail shipments. But the situation in the East, as we talked about at great length last week with the Rockefeller stuff and the Ida Tarbell book, was one of uneven and discriminatory pricing and prices that were actually too low to support operational costs or other financial needs of the railroad. As Rachel just alluded to, we're talking about, you know, railroads loading themselves up on debt because they have money-losing operations that they refuse to get rid of. And we're going to talk about why that happened and some of the factors at play and what they were trying to accomplish or being forced into doing. And this was how, again, Rockefeller was able to exploit that situation to make himself this very powerful oil company. So railroads were the second largest industry in the United States after the Civil War. The only larger industry was, of course, agriculture. There was a massive boom in construction of tens of thousands of miles of track, often funded with government subsidies, sometimes federal, sometimes state, sometimes even counties and cities got in on it. And there was also, as Rachel said, vast amounts of private speculator investments, in many cases very ill-advised investments. They did not do their homework on these companies to see if they were even really building, you know, decent railroads or actually building railroads at all. And this culminated in The overbuilding period that collapsed when 115 railroad companies failed over the course of the Panic of 1873. So a wave of them initially fell apart right as the market crashed in 1873, and then a bunch of them failed within about a year after that. We are going to be talking this week about, as I said, this narrow geographical area in the east, and we're going to be talking about a period of just a couple of years before and after the Panic of 1873. This is, I think, important for understanding, again, as we talked about with Standard Oil last week, the rise of the original Gilded Age, which another great point of comparison to today. You know, people say, oh, we're in the second Gilded Age. This is the origins of a lot of American capitalism as we understand it today, not necessarily the neoliberal style of capitalism that we currently have, but a lot of the foundations are established in this period as you hit the second industrial revolution. The first industrial revolution also had a great deal to do with a lot of these railroad companies, but many of those railroads had already been built at this point that we're talking about in this region of the country. However, as we said, there was a lot of construction still happening in the West, and there was going to be a lot more traffic coming in through places like Chicago and St. Louis that then needed to get to the Atlantic seaboard. And so this is the time period and the place that we're talking about. Now, there was a Supreme Court case in 1876, Munn v. Illinois, responding to the Granger movement. And again, the Granger movement was established in 1867, the National Grange of the Order of Patrons of Husbandry. And they were often representing farmers in various parts of the country, including places like New York, but especially in the West. And again, their concern was excessively high rates. So the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the state of Illinois, which had been lobbied by the Granger Farm Lobby, that states had the power to set maximum rates for storage and shipping of goods on privately owned common carriers and de facto utilities. The company Munn and Scott, which is in the decision title, was a grain storage company, and they were considered to be, by the Supreme Court case, a de facto utility, even though they were privately owned. This decision remained in force from 1876 for 10 years until the 1886 Wabash Railroad decision reversed it and led to the creation of the Interstate Commerce Commission, as we noted last week. But that's outside of the scope that we are talking about, in particular because, again, this is part of our series on the early U.S. oil industry, especially with the Pennsylvania oil rush. And by the time of the Wabash decision in 1886, the oil industry had basically moved on to new regions beyond Pennsylvania, and it was on the way out as the oil-producing hub. But again, these maximum rates under Munn v. Illinois were a greater concern to railroads west of Chicago than to railroads east of Chicago, where they had the opposite problem of the rates literally being too low to operate financially successfully. It's critical to understand, however, that the rates in the East were only low for shippers who were receiving those rebates that we discussed last week, many of which were basically off the books and not especially legal, usually given due to huge volume from a preferred customer shipper. And this helps explain why the general public, as we will talk about at numerous points in this episode, remained angry about high shipping rates despite the railroads actually losing money. Now, the Grangers had a significant political and policy effect all over the country, including the East. That is, again, as I said, why you might have read about them in something like an AP U.S. history course. But they are outside of the sphere of our discussion because they were not that important to the Pennsylvania oil industry issues with the railroads. So, Rachel, one of the other reasons that the rates were so low was not necessarily because of these rebates, but was, in fact, because of the poor financial health of these railroads. As you said, the use of debt or manipulation of the situations around debt problems. And this became especially a big problem when you had this huge panic in 1873 that put a lot of railroads out of business. Not all these railroads disappeared overnight, though, and many of them continued to operate for many years longer. Talk to us about receivership and the way that that functioned in these rate wars that we were seeing that people like Rockefeller were able to take advantage of.
Right. So when railroads were in receivership, they were kind of operating in this bankruptcy status. And so they had no interest charges to pay down their debt. They also were not earning enough to pay dividends on capital stock. So they were basically freed of their burdens of both these charges and their obligations to their stockholders. So because they were freed of these obligations, they were free to reduce rates in the hope of attracting traffic away from their rivals who were operating under a solvent status. So they were having to meet these interest charges and paying dividends to stockholders, depending on how much of a profit they were turning. So these railroads in receivership had little to lose and much to gain, either through increasing their traffic and their earnings, or actually forcing their competitors who did have these charges to pay to yield and divide traffic or earnings. One prime example is the Erie Railroad, which actually went bankrupt multiple times during this time period.
And that was a major railroad, as we noted in last week's episode on Standard Oil's manipulations of the three major carriers, which we're going to be talking about in this region today. As I said earlier, you can go to arsenalfordemocracy.com to get the PDF with this episode that has all the citations. Rachel was just quoting from an article on encyclopedia.com that's specifically about the issue of railroads in receivership during this time period. But this was, as Rachel said, a persistent struggle that the railroads had to deal with. Two other things that sort of highlight this. I think you wanted to talk about the role that the Grand Trunk played in some of these disputes between the railroads.
Yeah, the Grand Trunk of Canada also was in this receivership status. So they were under no obligation to like play nicely with any other railroads. So they were kind of ruthless in slashing their rates that they were charging for shipping. So they kind of were able to thwart any efforts to keep rates at a reasonable level.
A similar problem that could also be compounded by this receivership issue was the absolute density of the railroads in this particular region, because these were established railroading areas for the most part that had been in place since the first Industrial Revolution or shortly thereafter. And there was, as the theme we're going to keep coming back to over and over again, was this concept of overbuilding. And certainly that was also happening in the West, but it was also a significant problem in both the Northeast and the Southeast in the post-Civil War period. Simply too high of a density of railroads in the area. And actually, if you jump forward to the 1880s, although we're not going to be talking about that too much today, at one point there was a couple of a few guys in Ohio who figured out that they could actually exploit this situation intentionally, and they built the Nickel Plate Railroad right next to the Lakeshore Railroad, which had been basically recently acquired by the New York Central. And they built this, they took on all this debt, built this really expensive new railroad next to this line that was now under the control of the New York Central, knowing that their own railroad was not going to have good enough finances to actually operate. It was, a total mess. But because it was next to an existing line under the control of one of the major carriers, and they were obviously going to go bankrupt themselves, they knew that they could sell out to this railroad or to one of its rivals potentially, because failure to buy out that railroad would then mean that you had a railroad next to your main line in this area that was serving all the same cities and towns, but doing so in receivership status and therefore at a much lower rate. Sort of just an open con scheme by the future governor of Ohio and the future Ohio U.S. Senator Charles Foster and Calvin S. Bryce, respectively. But this was a persistent problem that was happening in this time period that we're talking about, was this issue of excessive competition and then excessive rate warring, and the issue of the bad finances of these railroads, especially the ones that collapsed in the 1870s, outcompeting the railroads that were still trying to function as normal. So let's talk about this a little bit further. This ruinously intense, as one person put it, price undercutting among the railroads around the time of the oil rush in Pennsylvania. So Harlow, in his book on the New York Central, cites the Tarbell book that we've been discussing on the previous episodes, quoting her as saying, any big producer or refiner could bully a freight agent into a special rate. Rockefeller himself told Congress, quote, a public rate was made and collected by the railroads, but so far as my knowledge extends, seldom retained in full. A portion was repaid to the shippers as a rebate. By this method, the real rate of freight which any shipper paid was not known by his competitors, nor by other railroads, the amount being a matter of bargain with the carrying companies. Later on in 1904, George W. Alger in McClure's magazine, writing a muckraking piece, criticized the railroads, but outlined the problem with their situation. Quote, the railroads were fighting for a chance to live. They were interstate railroads, and there was no federal legislation of any kind governing them. They could not agree among themselves as to rates, and competition among them was ruinously intense. They needed control by law, and there was no law on the federal statute books which governed them. Such state laws as there were did not apply to interstate commerce, were weak and insufficient. They must do something. They had millions of dollars invested in their rights of way, in their tracks and rolling stock. They had to do business, carry on this enormous oil traffic, even at a loss. Not one of them was willing to move its business out of the oil regions like a disappointed grocery or a discouraged saloon would. But with cutthroat competition, they could make no money. What could they do? The oil trust, meaning Rockefeller's scheme, furnished the answer. Where there is an economic condition which absolutely requires a law and the state fails to provide it, somebody else will. The schemers for an oil monopoly furnished that law. And remember that, the as we talked about last week, the railroads were considered common carriers. They couldn't really refuse business in order to, you know, not take losses. So as long as they were in the region, they pretty much had to provide rail service to the various companies, and they didn't want to leave because, of course, they had poured huge amounts of capital into expanding rail service either to the refinery areas or to the oil region itself in this period around the time of the discovery of oil. So again, it's not just that there were these rate wars and that Rockefeller was able to exploit them. It's also that they found themselves essentially backed into a corner where they had to come up with some sort of a conspiracy plan amongst themselves or have one imposed on them by someone like Rockefeller. We talked last week about him coming in and dividing up percentages of oil traffic and saying this railroad gets this percentage, this railroad gets this percentage, and so on. They had to do that because they had a situation where they had these rate wars that were completely unsustainable. We'll also talk about in a bit that the Erie Canal was another competitor as well that was kind of keeping a cap on how high the price could go in this particular region. But this is the situation. This explains, you know, as we said last week, we were going to talk this week about the perspective of the railroads on that conspiracy we discussed last week. It only really makes sense if you look at it from the point of view of the railroads. Otherwise, why would they have agreed to these terms that seem so unfavorable to them? And it's because of the situations that they were facing at the same time. Now, there were a whole bunch of different rate wars that happened. There was rate wars before the Civil War. There were rate wars in the late 1860s. There were rate wars in the 1870s. One example that really highlights this problem is that there was a passenger fare rate war as opposed to a freight rate war that broke out between the New York Central and the Pennsylvania in 1875 and lasted to at least 1877. And this was concurrent with the 1876 Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia. There was a lot of people taking trains from various parts of the country to go see it. And both of the railroads were charging so little money for tickets to it that neither of them really ended up making any money off of this huge boom in passenger traffic to Philadelphia. Not particularly a great situation for any of them. If we go to the official corporate history of the Pennsylvania Railroad that was published in 1946 on the centennial of their company, they do talk about the rate wars from the point of view of the Pennsylvania Railroad and kind of talk about the different phases that happened. As I said, there were multiple rate wars that happened. Chapter 15, kind of because it's an official corporate history, I found glossed over a lot of this, you know, saying like, well, this is a story told elsewhere, or there's no need to go into detail about this, basically because they didn't want to admit how culpable they were in the Rockefeller schemes. Even in 1946, they didn't really want to admit it. But if you look at the, there are some specific later chapters that go into a bit more depth. The first mention of a rate war for traffic of the West, and here the West is referring to anything that's not just west of Chicago and St. Louis, but also even just west of the Atlantic seaboard, occurs in Pennsylvania's annual report for the year 1858. This reference states, "The effect of the unwise competition for the carrying trade between the East and West, which prevailed for a time during the past year, induced the officers of the New York Central, New York and Erie, Baltimore and Ohio, and Pennsylvania Railroad Companies to meet in convention for the purpose of agreeing upon remunerative rates, abolishing injudicious practices, and effecting a harmony of purpose conducive to the mutual advantage of the railway interest and the public." And actually, we'll talk about this as well, but a lot of times the railroads tried to pitch this as being to the benefit of the public, that they were forming cartels with each other and trying to divide up traffic and set rates. The public didn't necessarily agree, but we can get into that debate later. An arrangement was agreed upon, which took effect on the 1st of October last, and the advantages thus far resulting from this compact seem to demonstrate the propriety of its continuance. The same report, as the book notes, also points out, however, that sharper competition than ever before is in the offing with the enlarged New York Canal and its numerous steamers. This new competition was apparently effective in destroying the harmony of purpose among the railroads, for the report the next year remarks that while the traffic of the road has increased, earnings from freight have not kept pace in consequence of the competition between the New York Central Railroad and transporters on the Erie Canal. On another page, however, we come to what, over a considerable period of years, was the more important consideration in the battle between the trunk lines, which was joined in vigorously by the seaboard cities which they served. Quote, "It has been the policy of your board to seek an increase of traffic for the road by securing freights destined to every part of the world, in all cases where they believed they could add to the profits of the shareholders, while they have with equal care sought to protect the manufacturing and commercial interests of Philadelphia, whose means have been so liberally embarked in the enterprise by such differences in her favor in the rates of freight as are due to the shorter distance it is to be transported to and from the West. More than this could scarcely be asked of the company, and more, if demanded, would not be permitted by the competing lines of transportation between the East and West. During the past year, the New York Central Railroad, in an unreasonable, if sincere, effort to bring the rates to and from New York to the same level as with those of Philadelphia and Baltimore, sacrificed hundreds of thousands of dollars to herself and rivals without attaining her object, beyond temporarily destroying the uniformity of these differences in rates." In other words, the Pennsylvania was attempting to, as it had since its line was completed, to maintain a rate differential on the competitive Western traffic in favor of Philadelphia as against New York, and the Baltimore and Ohio was attempting to keep below both of them in rates to and from Baltimore, both arguing that such differentials had a sound basis in the relative distances between those ports in the interior. This seemed a sensible argument, and there was another one which went with it, one of great practical importance, as concerning import and export traffic. Ocean rates from Philadelphia to Europe were higher than from New York, and from Baltimore still higher. Therefore, if wheat shipped from England via Philadelphia were to bring its owners the same profit as if it had been shipped by New York, the rail rate from farm to Philadelphia would have been low enough to offset the higher ocean rate from Philadelphia to Liverpool. All this was fine, except that New York would have none of it. Her merchants and shippers claimed that her advantage in ocean rates was not caused by distance, but by various natural advantages, as well as by the superior facilities supplied by man, and to a considerable extent this was true. Another important truth was that New York had got her first great advantage over her rival ports by reason of cheap transportation on the Erie Canal as compared with the overland routes, and thus was particularly loath to accept an equalization of the rail ocean rates via all ports. The battle lapsed during the Civil War when all the trunk lines had all the traffic they could handle, but broke out with increased vigor when the war traffic ceased. The fact was that railway mileage had increased much faster than even the rapid growth of the West had required, and there was considerable excess of carrying capacity, which was a constant temptation to rate cutting on some pretext or other. And of course, it's important to note here as well that the antebellum rate war ended with the boom in wartime traffic. Anyway, in chapter 22, it notes that in 1867, the rate wars broke out again. The annual report for that year describes how the Erie and New York Central attempted to break up through the traffic arrangements of this company by large reductions in their freight charges, and how the Pennsylvania met the challenge with still greater reductions, which resulted in a large increase in its tonnage. It appears that the others finally begged for mercy and the rates were restored, but the effort increased the prestige of this company by bringing its shorter lines and its better facilities more prominently into public notice. In 1870, it is noted that freight revenue decreased despite an increase in tonnage, which is mainly accounted for by the reduction of freight charges without any legitimate object, as they themselves said in their corporate reports, during the past summer and autumn by the New York lines to a point much below cost of transportation. And apparently from 1871 through 1873, there was traffic enough for all the roads without attempting to steal each other's business. So this is the situation that we're talking about here. This is the situation in which Rockefeller is able to swoop in and say, I'm going to offer you a way out of these rate wars. I'm going to offer you a deal that is going to give, divide up the traffic appropriately, that is going to stabilize the freight rates, that's going to guarantee you business, et cetera, et cetera. These are all things that they were looking for at this point, because they were operating often at an outright loss, in terms of their freight shipping. There were subsequent rate wars in the mid-1870s when Standard Oil was really starting to come into its own. And I wonder, Rachel, if you could talk a little bit about that as you read those particular chapters in the Pennsylvania Railroad History Book.
Yeah, so as we mentioned last week, Standard Oil not only got rebates for shipping their oil, they also got a cut of the rates that other independent companies were paying to Pennsylvania. So it was really, really lucrative for them, because they won either way, no matter who was shipping on the Pennsylvania line. Standard Oil came out on top.
And I think we saw similarly with the Erie Railroad. We talked last week about their terminals at the port cities where they would offload the other oil companies' oil themselves. Like, that was another deal that they got where they were basically able to exploit this to make money off their competitors.
Right. So in the mid-1870s, another rate war broke out, and the new president of the Erie Railroad, H.J. Jewett, tried to solve this rate war through agreements with the presidents of New York Central and Pennsylvania and smaller, the smaller Western railroads that hooked up to those major rail lines. So he proposed the elimination of rebating and the establishment of a commission that would make, quote, such moderate rates as would be reasonable and just to the public and give in the future equal and uniform rates to every shipper, unquote. However, Baltimore and Ohio didn't send a commissioner to this meeting, and Grand Trunk of Canada was, as we said before, was in receivership and had nothing to lose by continuing to slash rates. Also, the New York public believed that New York Central had sold out to these other rail lines, so there was kind of a resentment around these agreements to charge similar rates. So since these commissioners weren't able to control the Grand Trunk, their low rates caused traffic to divert to Boston. So in 1875, Boston to Chicago rates were 50% lower than New York to Chicago. So in response, New York Central cut rates up to 60%, escalating yet another rate war, despite these agreements that were put into place. In April of 1876, passenger fare between Boston and Chicago dropped from $25.85 to $14, and freight rate on ag products from Chicago to New York fell from 70 cents per hundred to 18 cents. I'm guessing that's based on tonnage, that per hundred. And the westward rate of 2.8 mils per ton mile was less than half the Pennsylvania's average cost of shipping. So they were actually losing money on shipping agricultural products west.
And mils is thousandth of a dollar instead of pennies.
Right. Just because they were working on such a grand, grand scale, they had to subdivide the currency even into fractions of pennies. Colonel Albert Fink was brought in 1877 to pool these railroad revenues. He had successfully done this in the Southeast when he was the vice president of the Louisville and Nashville Railroad. This pool included about 30 railroad and steamboat lines, and he had administered its fares as commissioner. So he came into New York to form this pool for westbound traffic from New York. So 33% of westbound traffic was assigned to Central and Erie rail lines, 25% to Pennsylvania, and 9% to Baltimore and Ohio. And this was based on traffic rates for the previous few years, I believe. So this was on westbound traffic. Colonel Fink also pulled eastbound traffic in 1879. The public was suspicious of this pooling, but it did keep the lines from destroying themselves through these rate wars. And I believe this pool was in place until the 1880s, when the Interstate Commerce Commission was put into place.
So as Rachel just noted, the public was aware of some, though not all, of these sort of cartel arrangements between the railroads, and they were mostly pretty unhappy with it. So that we know that the railroads tried to make various public overtures at the time to explain why they were doing what they were doing. In 1877, as another piece of contextual information, there was a massive railroad strike. We're going to probably talk about that on a different episode of Arsenal for Democracy, where we can focus more heavily on that. That was something that was also happening at the same time, because in part because one of the consequences of these rate wars was that the amount of money they were making was so small on the shipping that in order to try to save costs, they started trying to cut the pay of the rail workers, who understandably weren't happy about that. But in June, that strike was in 1877. In June of 1878, so at this point, we're past the strike. We are into the period of this cartel arrangement, pooling arrangement being formed, not by Rockefeller, but by the railroads themselves in this case, by Colonel Fink, as Rachel just described. We have William H. Vanderbilt, also known as Billy Vanderbilt, his father, who's known as the Commodore, had recently died. And so now he was in charge of the New York Central. In that book on the New York Central by Harlow, we read that in June of 1878, he wrote, and basically I guess it was an open letter in the Chicago Times, defending these arrangements. "The great commercial, financial, agricultural, and industrial interests of this country are all injured by such competition as heretofore prevailed, with its attendant uncertainties, by such a check as would secure fair profits. What the people want is certainty and moderate prices for freight. The object of all pooling arrangements is to bring about this result. If any other scheme will work better, then I am in favor of that. High rates in the future are utterly impossible. The people are safe from extortionate charges. Stability of prices, fair rates for transportation, equitable dealings with shippers, and general prosperity can be had only through some understanding embraced in what is generally styled a pool." This pool split the freight business in the region, and of course came 3 years after the efforts that we talked about last week with Empire Transportation Company and Rockefeller trying to negotiate proportional shares of the oil traffic in the region. That was not mentioned in the book, though, at this point. But the other thing, of course, as we said, is there was immense price competition from the Erie Canal and the Great Lakes shipping, and that had managed to push down the price of moving a bushel of corn from Chicago to New York City to just 7.5 cents for the entire distance. That's not 7.5 cents per mile, that's 7.5 cents for the entire distance for a bushel of corn. And this is why it's not stated in explicitly in this letter in the Chicago Times, but that's why he's basically arguing that there's not a danger of them having excessively high rates by doing this cartel arrangement amongst themselves, because they were still having to compete with the Erie Canal and the Great Lakes shipping. But what we can see here is similar rhetoric to the original deal that was pitched by Rockefeller in 1872, that would have been, 6 years earlier or so, with the South Improvement Company, right? He went to the railroads and said, "The arrangement that I'm proposing with the various pooling and the fixed rates offers the railroads the advantage of stability and actual, volumes of traffic and prices that they can sustain themselves and maintain operational costs and pay off their debts and pay off their shareholders. And that it would be beneficial to the public because it would give stability of rates. Yes, it might mean that the rates might go up a little bit, but it would be stable rates. There would be certainty, and that would be advantageous to the public as well." Again, Not sure that the public necessarily agreed, but you can see this rhetorical through line from the early 1870s into the late 1870s as these pool arrangements, which it took them many attempts going back to the 1850s to try to work out amongst themselves, finally started to come to fruition. Again, this is before the Interstate Commerce Commission was formed in 1886, although even that was relatively toothless for a long time. So that is sort of the public-facing dimension of this. Now, again, you might be thinking about this and saying, well, you know, and this is probably what the public was saying, was like, well, what do I care about if the railroads are, you know, not able to charge an appropriate rate for their freight? And the answer is that, again, you had the companies that were bankrupt that were undercutting each other, but the ultimate effect of undercutting these companies for long enough is that more companies end up going into bankruptcy and having other severe financial problems. And again, you can say, well, what do I care? But the problem is this started becoming a compounding issue, and it's one that is, again, should be raising your alarm bells in terms of certain modern parallels. The Erie Railroad in particular had a lot of challenges and reputational problems because of how many times it went bankrupt. We mentioned that earlier. And they were definitely the worst of the struggling railroads in the East. But the consequence of the low rates, along with the severe debt problems, meant that a railroad like that was unable to make meaningful investments in upgrading or expanding their infrastructure. Now, Rachel, as we talked about last week, a lot of this pooling arrangements between the railroads, although they had made previous attempts, ends up resulting from some of the direct hand of Standard Oil, especially as it became larger and larger and more powerful. It was able to dictate certain terms and set some of the rates themselves. And again, we see here that in some cases, they were not just saying, oh, give us a special deal at a discount, although they certainly were, but also were saying, we need a rational system of doing these rates in a stable manner across this region. So you have one more chapter here, which is chapter 27, in the Pennsylvania Railroad's own history, although they are pretty reluctant to talk about the way that Standard Oil influenced their operations at this time. What can we glean from this?
So Pennsylvania did have this arrangement whereby Standard Oil gained no matter who was shipping, whether it was Standard Oil shipping oil or independent refiners shipping oil. They got a cut of everything, basically. All this oil that was shipped on the Pennsylvania line was shipped in cars owned by the Empire Transportation Company, which we've talked about in past episodes, which, although it was independent of Pennsylvania, they did work closely in cooperation. So American Transfer Company, secretly owned by Standard Oil, started aggressively building pipelines. In response, Empire acquired two refineries, one in Philadelphia and one in New York, to compete with this American Transfer Company. They kind of sussed out that Standard Oil was in charge of this operation. So when they acquired these two refineries, Rockefeller protested that a public transportation company shouldn't also own refineries, as they would favor their own refineries, which is pretty rich coming from Rockefeller, who was trying to consolidate ownership over most of the steps of the oil business. So in 1877, Rockefeller refused to ship on Pennsylvania unless Empire gave up its refineries. So Pennsylvania was kind of supportive of Empire, and they refused to bow to their demand, to Standard Oil's demands, and immediately lost 65% of its oil traffic overnight. Empire kind of tried to rally the independent refiners against Standard Oil, but the competing rail lines engaged in yet another rate war, which undermined their efforts to kind of unite the independent refiners against Standard Oil. By the summer of 1877, Pennsylvania could no longer afford to stand by Empire, and bought out Empire's cars and all the accompanying, like, rail yards and everything like that. Standard Oil bought Empire's pipelines and, quote, thereafter had producers, transporters, and independent refiners largely at its mercy. So Standard was able to set up its own new pooling agreement. 63% of traffic was to go to New York, and Pennsylvania Rail Line got 1/3 of this traffic. Of the remaining 37% of traffic going to Philadelphia and Baltimore, Pennsylvania would have 26 of that 37%. Standard guaranteed Pennsylvania 2 million barrels of oil per year, and in return, the Pennsylvania would pay a 10% commission on all the traffic Standard controlled. This arrangement remained in place, but ultimately, pipelines kind of won out and replaced railroads for moving oil.
As we talked about a little bit last week at the end of the episode, originally oil pipelines were relatively short distance, but by this point in the mid to late 1870s, we have companies starting to build long distance pipelines, which is, of course, how we move most of the oil today. There's still obviously a significant traffic over rail as well, but that, as you said, outcompeted in many ways. And again, in Standard Oil's case, he was really only negotiating the oil traffic, but it did set that precedent, right? So this dispute with, you know, it was happening in 1877, 1878, and this is at the same time that the railroads themselves, with this Colonel Fink guy, are attempting to negotiate a pool of rail revenues and shipping volumes amongst themselves for all businesses. But again, I want to go back to that quote that I read at the beginning of the show that indicates again why we're talking about the railroads in specifically the context with the oil industry. Again, we're talking in a period here that is as much as 10 years before, or even longer, really, in terms of the broader rate wars, but with specifically the oil industry and Standard Oil's role, we're talking about 10 years before the creation of the Interstate Commerce Commission in 1886. And as that journalist in McClure's magazine had written in 1904, talking specifically about this period, you know, and he's talking about all these problems of them not making any money with the cutthroat competition and so forth. The oil trust furnished the answer. Where there is an economic condition which absolutely requires a law and the state fails to provide it, somebody else will. The schemers for an oil monopoly furnished that. That is why these two things are inextricably linked together and why the railroads were willing to accept Rockefeller bossing them around on a bunch of stuff and making what we would otherwise consider to be fairly unreasonable deals. Now, Rachel, as we wrap up this episode, looking ahead, we're going to be talking next week about the role that market force capital played in developing both the early oil industry and developing the railroads in this period, or expanding and reinvesting in the railroads. We're going to be talking about the issue of monopolies and whether things should be state monopolies, whether monopolies are inherently a problem or not. These are picking up on themes we've discussed on Arsenal for Democracy previously for other topics, but we're going to drill down on them specifically in the context of the oil industry and the railroads in this geographical region, in this specific time period of American history. And then, of course, we will be talking the week after that on more explicitly on modern parallels to the rise of the Gilded Age monopolism, then and now. But as we wrap up this episode, Rachel, what are some takeaway themes from this week that you think are important for people to understand in the rail price wars and why we're talking about this?
So something that kind of came up in both the oil story and the railroad story is the fact that all this private investment flooded, and then there just became these huge inefficiencies or redundancies in the system. So like we talked about last week, there was the ability to refine 3 barrels of oil for every barrel of oil that got extracted. And then in the rail lines, there were, I think it's in some cases, 7 rail lines going to and from the same places. So I think something that we need to keep in mind is just the fact that in this early capitalism, it wasn't the most efficient system, because we saw these redundancies and these inefficiencies pop up, and it kind of became the job of the private, the winner, to try to make it profitable for the industry. And so in cases like that, who gets to decide who gets to control the rates or who gets to win? And in this case, it was the big names like Rockefeller or the big rail lines that decided that. But was that necessarily the person who had everybody's interests in mind? Obviously not. So was he the best person to make those decisions on who got to win and who got to lose?
And I think, as you said there, the last man standing effect is obviously a huge parallel to what we see today, right? You have tons and tons and tons of private capital flooding in to investing in companies that are not necessarily particularly sound, do not necessarily have any actual viable shot at being a successful company. They can still have a profound effect on the market, especially if they are willing to operate at enormous losses for extended periods of time to achieve various other objectives. And who gets to be that last company that's standing that suddenly becomes the monopoly that can actually operate at a whether it's a profit or even just at cost, because in many cases they were operating below the actual operational costs. So those are things to keep in mind, keep in the back of your head going forward as we continue our series looking at the early U.S. oil industry and the railroad industry in parallel to it in this part of the country in the period of the 1870s and the early Gilded Age. This is, again, we're talking the beginnings of the second industrial revolution in the United States and understanding. It's also, you know, we can talk in a future episode, like it's interesting to see that, you know, there wasn't much of a change in the rail industry with all of those, you know, 100 plus companies going bankrupt with the Panic of 1873, whereas in some other countries around the world, the government stepped in and just nationalized the rail systems right then. And that really did not happen and enforced these various cartel arrangements. And we're going to drill down again into more about why that emerges and you know, the natural monopoly concept and of a lot of utilities and things like that. Rachel, thank you again for being on this week.
Thanks, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
And we will be, as you may have noticed, this is an hour episode or slightly less than an hour. We will be going back to that length of format effective this week with our hosts at WVUD in Delaware. And that will be maintained through the summer months. And then we expect returning to the half hour format in the fall. Thanks for being with us.